All of you read the flyer, so you have a general idea of Gary's biography. Let's suffice to say two things about him. First of all, he is, in the nonfiction area, one of the, if not the, best-selling author, including his books and pamphlets, in American history, period. Secondly, I think we have a great problem in this world today with a lot of people who have armchair opinions. They can sit and tell you what they think of a situation. They've never tried to apply it practically. They've never gone out and put the solutions into working order. Gary has. He is not an academician who has made up some theories and wants to spit them back at you. He not only fights inflation, but he has become the head of his own independent business, American Buyer Service, which proposes an actual personal solution for you and your individual family to fight inflation, at the same time as proposing solutions to get the government out of the free market so that we can let our market operate. So without further, I give you Gary Allen.
You people are about to learn why I am a writer, not a speaker. I have done something like 77 consecutive articles in American Opinion magazine, and every once in a while somebody makes the mistake of asking me, where do I get all that information? So I'm going to show you where an article in American Opinion comes from. This is a file marked Energy Power File 1, Shortages. And in here, I subscribe to three daily newspapers, the Congressional Record, the Wall Street Journal, Time, Newsweek, and all those. And every day I take a felt tip pen and I go through all this stuff and I mark for my secretary to file. And you wind up with a large file on a large number of subjects. And then when it's decided to write an article, I get the file out and I start going through and pulling out what I think is the best information. And a lot of what I'm going to talk to you tonight is stuff that I just pulled out of the file rather than putting together a formal speech. A lot of the statistics and figures and whatnot, if I throw them at you tonight, you'll just forget them. If you really want to know what's going on, there's just no substitute for reading. I got into this not too long after I was out of college, and I came in very much as a skeptic. I had a friend from college who had become one of these rabid birchers and started shoving all these books and pamphlets at me, and I looked at him with very much of a jaundiced eye because I had majored in history at Stanford University, and I was a liberal. And naturally, being a liberal, there was nothing worth knowing I didn't already know. And he came at me with all of this stuff, and I only read it because I wanted to show the poor guy how deluded he was. And I found out that my friend knew more about history than I did, and there was a whole lot of history that I didn't study at school. In fact, I tell people now that I majored in Marxian history at Stanford. They say, well, all that sounds like a fascinating subject. I say, well, yeah, it really was, but they didn't tell me it was Marxian while I was taking it. You came here tonight to hear about shortages. But as far as understanding the shortages and what causes them, we have to talk about some other things, a little background. You go out to the American public today and say, what is bugging you the most? You'll get two answers. One, inflation is bugging them. And two, shortages. And most people think of these as being two separate problems. They just sort of happen to come up at the same time. Actually, excuse me. Shortages are the other side of the inflation coin. When you have inflation, you're going to have shortages. And when you cure one, you can cure the other. So I'm going to take a good portion of my talk discussing with you what is really behind inflation. There was a group, I'm going to give you a little bit of history now because it's very important to what's going on in this country. There was a group that was started in Europe in the late 1800s whose philosophy has had an absolutely fantastic impact on the United States of America, and yet practically nobody has ever heard of this group. You see, back in the late 1800s, there were a number of Marxist factions in Europe, and they got to fighting among themselves. And it sort of broke down into two groups. One was the group that said the only way to establish a communist or Marxist state is by an armed revolution. The workers must arise, the toilers must throw off their chains, they must man the barricades, and there must be blood in the streets. And there was another group, a group made up largely of scholars, of men of literary talent, and these men were repelled at the idea of blood in the streets. And they said, there is another way. They said, we can establish the same thing nonviolently. They're broken down into two groups, the violence and the nonviolence. And the nonviolence made their stand like this. They said, look, in some backwards country, you may get the proletariat to arise and have an overt revolution. But in a modern industrial nation, the working class just isn't going to do it. What we can do is we can bring about a Marxist state little by little through the ballot box instead of a flaming revolution. These groups organized themselves, and in England they were called the Fabian Socialist Society. And the whole idea of Fabian socialism was summed up by their logo, which had a turtle crawling on it. And their idea was little by little. Now they also, at their home office, they have this kind of a logo on the wall, and it's on the front of this book called The Great Deceit, put out by a Harvard group. But it shows a flag here in the background, and it says FS on the flag. That's for Fabian Socialism. And holding the flag is a wolf in sheep's clothing. Now, you really don't have to be too swift to figure out what they're trying to tell you here. They even were so audacious about what they were doing that one of their most famed members, a man you've all heard of, a fellow named H.G. Wells, famous British historian, he wrote a book called The Open Conspiracy. The Open Conspiracy. In which he said, most people aren't going to listen to us anyway, so we don't have to hide what we're trying to do. And what we're going to do is we will tear down any ideas of patriotism. We will tear down any belief in religion. We will build a stronger and stronger government, and government will take over more and more of the functions of individuals and the functions of business until we will wind up with a one-world socialist government. He wrote a book about it, The Open Conspiracy, because he figured that the business and professional people, the people who were to be the victims, were just too darn dumb to defend themselves. Most people have heard of this book. It's called The Communist Manifesto, written by Karl Marx in 1848. Everybody's heard of this book, practically nobody's read it. Now, most people think that this is a book about how to make bombs and how to man the barricades and how to foment bloody revolution. Not at all. It's really a book about Fabian gradualism, of establishing communism little by little through the ballot box. In here on page 156 of this issue, the 56. Karl Marx gives us the Ten Commandments for establishing communism. Commandment number one, very broad, abolition of property. Two, a heavy progressive or graduated income tax. That's a Fabian move. You don't establish a graduated income tax with SDS revolutionaries in the street. Three, abolition of all right of inheritance. And here's one of the most important ones. Centralization of credit in the hands of the state by means of a national bank. In other words, the state is going to take control of the money supply, which we did in this country in 1913. Well, it goes on and on, talking about various Fabian policies. One of the founders of the Fabian Society in England was another fellow, famous playwright I'm sure you've all heard of, George Bernard Shaw. Shaw said, quote, "As a founder of the Fabian Socialist Society, I am basically a Marxist communist." Now, there was a very famous Fabian economist by the name of John Maynard Keynes, K-E-Y-N-E-S. There is a book about him called Keynes at Harvard, put out by a Harvard alumni group. For businessmen, I recommend this most strongly as the most important book you can read. There is more information in this book than almost any other book I know of. When I first started getting into this, I read this book four times. And I'll tell you, you can't get all the information out of it the first time. It's that loaded. Keynes made the public statement that he was a Bolshevik. And he wrote to a friend of his and he said, "My theories will be the euthanasia of capitalism." In other words, the mercy killing of capitalism. And Keynes also wrote that there was no more subtle way to destroy a capitalist economy than through inflation. And then he proceeded to put together a theory of why countries should use inflation. In other words, he understood exactly what he was doing. And his idea was this. During times when business is bad, the government will spend more money than it takes in. In other words, it will run a deficit. Now, when the governments run deficits, the amount of the deficit is turned into brand new money. In other words, if the government runs a $10 billion deficit this year, there's going to be $10 billion of brand new money that never existed before in circulation. And Keynes's theory was, if we deficit spend during bad times, that will stimulate the economy, and then in good times, we'll run a surplus and pay off the deficits. Well, that sounds pretty reasonable, doesn't it? And he came over here in the 30s and he sold the idea to Franklin D. Roosevelt. In fact, Keynes has a really remarkable list of people who support him. Joseph Stalin was his first supporter. Pardon me, Lenin was his first supporter. Then came Mussolini praising the economics of John Maynard Keynes. Then Adolf Hitler. Then he sold his theories to Franklin D. Roosevelt. And then they were followed up by John Kennedy, Lyndon Johnson, and just 2 years ago, on a television program, Richard Nixon announced, "In economics, I am now a Keynesian." So here's Keynes's idea. We deficit spend, in other words, we inflate during bad times, and we pay it off during good times. Well, you know, as a theory, this might actually work, except that it's turned over to politicians. Now, politicians, what do they want? They want votes. They get votes by giving things away that don't belong to them. Politicians love to spend. They're not too keen on taxing, because people like to get free goodies from the government, but they don't like paying those taxes. So what has happened in reality ever since Keynes sold his idea to FDR is almost every year the government runs a deficit. It's all throttle and no brake. In good times or bad, they spend more than they take in, because the politicians haven't got the guts to tax you for what they're giving away. Now, there's some hidden economic factors in here that we'll get into, but let's all go back in our minds to when we were little kids. I realize that's a varying degree of time for people here. But I'm 37. I can remember when I was a little kid going to the movies for 6 cents. And then it went to 7 cents, and then it jumped to 11 cents, and then 14 cents, and then 20 cents, and 25 cents, and then 50 cents, and 75 cents, and I don't know what it is for kids now. I have this phenomenal memory about movie prices when I was a little kid. It's a dollar and a half now, okay. We have what is called a wage price spiral in this country. Everybody's worried about inflation. Now, what is inflation? Well, you go out and ask people, and they say, well, you know, that's wages and prices going up. Who's to blame? Well, you go out and you talk to somebody who's a Democrat, and he says it's those greedy businessmen. They're always raising prices. You go to a Republican, and he says it's those unions. Those workers always want more and more money without doing more work. So everybody's got their favorite scapegoat. Right up to the congressman. The Republican congressman blame the unions. The Democrat congressman blame businessmen. Now, what I'm going to tell you now, if you understand what I'm going to say, and it isn't all that hard, you're going to understand more about economics than a lot of guys walking around with PhDs in econ. The word inflation is used interchangeably with an increase in the cost of living, isn't it? If you go home tonight and you turn on all those reporters that didn't come here, they'll say, well, we had a 2% inflation last month. And what they mean is the cost of living went up 2%. That is not inflation. And if you can understand that the rising cost of living is not inflation, you have the key to understanding what they're doing to us. How can I say that the rising cost of living is not inflation? Well, I'll just read to you from Webster's New World Dictionary. Inflation, an increase in the amount of currency in circulation, resulting in a relatively sharp and sudden fall in its value and rise in prices. Now, is there anything in there about the wage price spiral? That's not inflation. Here's Webster, an increase in the amount of currency in circulation. Let me tell you what I mean. At one time in this country, not long ago, in 1933, there was $156 in money for for every man, woman, and child in the United States. Today, there is over $2,100 of money in circulation for every man, woman, and child. Imagine that. Despite our fantastic increase in population, the amount of money in circulation per capita has gone up about 18 times. Now, why do movies now cost a dollar and a half instead of 6 cents? Because they printed so much more money. I'm going to explain to you the wage-price spiral in a way that anybody can understand it. Let's talk about wages. It's Saturday morning. You happen to be the father or mother of 20 children. And each Saturday morning you call these kidlets before you and you say to them, it's work day. There's 20 of you and I have 20 jobs for each of you, or one job for each of you, 20 jobs. And I have here a platter of cookies, 20 cookies. And when each of you complete your job, you can come back and each one of you gets a cookie. Terrific. So one kid's out cleaning the windows and another one's taking the trash out, another one's cleaning the floor, and pretty soon they come back, you give them all a cookie. All right? One Saturday later, you have your plate of 20 cookies. The kids are all there. And there's this little girl there that takes after your wife. And she stands up and she says, Daddy, I'm not going to work today unless I get 2 cookies. If no 2 cookies, I'm going out on strike. And with that, the little rabble-rouser, all the kids jump up and they say, yeah, we want 2 cookies. Now, I've only got 20 cookies, right? And labor is demanding 40 cookies. Now, I'm not going to give you any monetary theory. I'm going to talk physics to you. There is no way I can give each one of those kids 2 cookies. I've got to increase the cookie supply. Otherwise, if I give little Mary 2 cookies, Sammy doesn't get any. Now, just project this out into the economy. You can't have everybody's wages going up in the economy unless there's more money available to pay them. Otherwise, if the bricklayers are getting a raise, then the carpenters have got to take a decrease. But that doesn't happen, does it? Everybody's getting a raise. How can this happen? Because there used to be $156 in circulation for everybody, and now there's $2,100. You can't have a general raise in wages unless there's more money available to pay. All right, now let's talk about prices. All our economy is a big auction in which thousands of people, or millions of people actually, are bidding every day on millions of products. Now, each one of you tonight has a certain amount of money with you in your wallet, don't you? All right, let's say I'm going to auction off my watch. Actually, we at American Buyer Service would sell you one at wholesale, but we will pretend that I'm going to auction off my watch. And right in the middle of this auction, let's say, a man from the Federal Reserve System bursts in the back door, and with him he has a big bushel basket full of brand new money. See, the government's run a deficit this year, so they printed a lot more money. And they say, you lucky, lucky people, you get more money. Here's a handful for you, sir. Here's your handful, ma'am. Here's some for you, some for you. Whoops, you're over 65, you don't get any. Well, that's the way that breaks. Greatest good for the greatest number, you know. And then the great benefactor leaves the room. And you've all got more money in your wallets than you had when you came in. Terrific! But what happens? You bid against each other and you bid the price of the watch up. Maybe the watch would have sold for $16 before, and now it sells for $19. Simply because there is more money in circulation. Now keep this in mind, because this is really important. All that brand new money that didn't exist before takes on value only by taking away from the value of the money you already had in your wallet. In other words, they're not doing any favors when they pump up that money supply. We got into this bad inflation during the period of Lyndon Johnson and the Vietnam War, in which he was pursuing the policy referred to as guns and butter. The liberals really had a dilemma. They didn't like the war, but they liked all of the new social programs that Lyndon came along with, so they didn't get on him too bad about this, but he started running major deficits. When Richard Nixon took over the government after making speeches denouncing what Lyndon Johnson had done to the money, our national debt was $350 billion. The greatest part of that run up during World War II. Our debt before Richard Nixon leaves office will be about $510 billion. In other words, from $350 billion to $510 billion, all during the term of a conservative, quote-unquote, fiscal responsible Republican president who vowed that the government would balance its budget so that you could balance yours. It's really amazing to read some of the speeches of Richard Nixon, because you know, in reading some of his old speeches, he knows exactly what he's doing. Because he used to outline exactly what would happen if the government kept running up these deficits. We're paying this year, just in interest on the national debt, $29 billion, which is bigger than the whole budget used to be. The third largest item in the budget now is interest, and it's climbing, it's doubled in the last 8 years, and pretty soon we'll be paying $50, $75, $100 billion a year just in interest on the debt. Now, we have a very funny money system in this country, in that the further in debt the government goes, the more money it has to spend. If it goes $20 billion in debt this year, it has $20 billion more to spend. Now, how would you women like to have that kind of a deal? You go down to Sears and Roebuck. You buy $250 worth of stuff. You come home. You simply step down into your basement, turn on the money machine, and crank out $350. No sweat, right? Oh, wouldn't you girls like to have that? Talk about a spur to the economy. But the government is doing this and has been doing it for years, and all of that money that it cranks out goes into circulation and devalues the money you already have in your pockets. Inflation, or an increase in the money supply, has been characterized as the economics of addiction. It's very much like a heroin addict. At the beginning of his career, it just takes a little jolt. But every time it takes a little bigger jolt. And pretty soon, if you go cold turkey, you get sick. This is why Keynes knew that once he got our government to start with his philosophy that administrations could come and go, but Keynesian economics would linger on. Because if once you start on this inflation routine, if you stop it, we have a recession or a depression. Just like the drug addict goes into withdrawals. You know the difference between a recession and a depression. A recession is when your neighbor's out of work. A depression is when you're out of work. Now, just a week ago last Tuesday, the head of our Federal Reserve, Mr. Burns, went before the House Banking Committee. And at the end of his talk, he opened it up for the congressman to talk to him about and ask him some specific questions. Up to now, the Nixon administration has, in most of their statements on the economy, have said something like this. Well, we're going through a temporary siege of inflation, by which they mean the cost of living. We're going through this temporary siege of inflation right now, but we think we've just about got it under control. 6 months from now, it'll all be over, the problem will be solved. So just bear with us. And we've heard that now for, what, 6 or 8 years? 6 years, I guess. Now, after 6 years, Burns, just 2 weeks ago, goes before the House Banking Committee and admits that in the near future, we are destined for what he referred to as two-digit inflation. That means somewhere between 10 and 99% a year. They've talked in the past about 3 and 4% inflation being acceptable. Now they're talking about two-digit inflation. And under further questioning, he said we may be headed for South American-style inflation. Caramba, what does that mean? South American-style inflation. Well, Brazil and some of these other countries down there for years have been running 50 to 60% a year inflation. In other words, the government increases the money supply 50% every year. That money goes out and circulates in the auction that is an economy, and it bids prices up 50 or 60% every year. You know, under Richard Nixon, the money supply has gone up just about 40%, and the cost of living has gone up just about 40%. And now they're talking about we are headed for South American-style inflation. Recent article out of the February 19th Los Angeles Times. Experts suspect Fed, that's the Federal Reserve that controls the money, of pumping up the economy. What do they mean by pumping up the economy? That means running those printing presses, man. Now, who is blamed for inflation? Well, they tried to blame it on the housewives. They said those housewives are out buying expensive cuts of meat. And the housewives blamed it on the cattle growers. Everybody's got a scapegoat. Now you know the secret. Unions don't cause inflation. Businessmen don't cause inflation. Housewives don't cause inflation. Cattle growers don't cause inflation. Oil people don't cause inflation. Why? Because none of them can print money. There isn't anybody in this room that can print money. Who prints money? Politicians. No wonder they want to blame everybody else. Again, the Republican politician blames people who tend to be Democrats, and the Democrats blame people who tend to be Republicans. The real guilty party are those guys in Congress who are spending money. When Richard Nixon took office, the last LBJ budget was $179 billion. And that was at the height, or actually just past the height, of the Vietnam War. Last year, Richard Nixon introduced what he referred to as his $270 billion starvation budget, which was a 50% spending increase in 5 years. This year, they're going to spend $306 billion. In other words, the last Lyndon Johnson budget was $179 billion. This year, it's $306 billion. Next year, they predict it's going to $352 billion. And when you ask these politicians why this spending is going up, they tell you, gee, we can't help it. The budget's out of control. They say, you know, there's 60 or 70 or 80% of that budget that is mandated to increase each year, and there's just nothing we can do about it. This keeps everybody happy. And it looks like, you know, gee, nothing anybody can do about it. Well, that's baloney. How does this come about, this thing that our budget is out of control? All right, let's assume that some clear Monday morning, Teddy Kennedy or somebody gets up in front of the Senate and says, my fellow senators, I have something to tell you that is going to make your hearts bleed. There are dogs in this country who are homeless and who have nothing to eat. A country that is as rich as the United States of America can certainly afford to take care of the dogs. And with that, he introduces canine care. And he says, it only costs us $1 billion and we can take care of the dogs. And all the other senators say, gee, $1 billion, that's a cheapie. You know, the conservatives are saying, well, I can go back to all the dogs in the district, and they'll like canine care, and I can go back to the conservatives and say it only costs $1 billion, and they'll be happy, yippee. So they pass this bill. They get canine care, costs $1 billion. But they don't just pass one-year appropriations, they pass five-year appropriations. And it's $1 billion first-year ticket, second-year $3.5 billion. Third year, $7 billion. Fourth year, $12 billion. And this little $1 billion program that everybody thought was a cheapie winds up costing $15 or $20 billion after 5 years. That's why they say it's out of control, because they passed a spending bill for 5 years ahead. So that as they go through time, they say, well, the law's already been passed. See, we'd love to cut spending, but there's nothing we can do about it. That is, unless they decide, nuts to the dog vote, we're going to cut out canine care. And that's more courage than the vast majority of them have. Richard Nixon gets away with all these tremendous increases in spending. The spending will be mandated to go, let's say, from $12 billion to $15 billion a year. And he'll come in and say, no, I'm going to veto that bill unless you cut it back to $14.5 billion. And this, oh, boy. All the liberals are saying, oh, that Nixon's a cheapskate. And all the conservatives are saying, nice going, Dick. Hang in there. And all the time, everybody's happy, and the government spending has gone up from $179 billion to $306. And according to U.S. News, by the end of this decade, government spending is going to be at $500 billion a year. Where's all the money going to come from? You've heard of Johann Gutenberg, haven't you? He invented the printing press. It may make you feel very good to know that you'll all be millionaires in your lifetime. Of course, when you go down to McDonald's, the hamburger is going to cost you $1,000. Take some of the glamour out of it, I'll admit. But, you know, this is unique in the United States. It's happened so many, many other places in the world. Probably the most famous runaway inflation occurred in Germany in 1922 and 1923, when money became so worthless that the government only printed one side of a bill. It wasn't worth the ink to put on both sides. And there were things like $10 billion postage stamps. And when people would die and the life insurance company would send the payoff, it cost more money to pay for the stamp than the check was inside. And people who had saved all their lives had their savings completely wiped out. Now, this is where inflation winds up unless the government steps in and stops increasing the money supply. But if that happens, then you go into a recession. That's why, this, you know, theoretically, we could stop inflation. But to do it is politically unpalatable. What we've established is a rob Peter and pay Paul economy. 25% of everything you earn goes to the federal government. Now, most of that is direct. You know, there's an awful lot of people that say, well, I'm only paying 15% taxes. Every time you go down and buy anything, you're paying federal taxes. It's hidden in the cost of everything you buy. And you're paying another 15% state and local taxes. So the average guy's in a 40% tax bracket today. Now, we could stop this. Let's say that there is a candidate for the presidency, and he goes over to the unions, and he says, look, the greatest drug disease in this country is not LSD, it's SFN, something for nothing. You guys in the unions, you're going to have to do an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. American productivity is falling behind the rest of the world. We're losing our competitive position in world markets. And you've got to go back to work. Oh, can't you hear the cheers on that one? You know, boo, hiss, fascist pig. So then our candidate goes into the boardroom. He's been out in the lunchroom talking to the workers. Now he goes in the boardroom. And he says, all right, no more subsidies for your business. No more fat government contracts at double what it ought to be. No more protecting you from competition. Oh, radical communist. Then he goes out to see the farmers. He says, we're not going to pay you for not planting this year. And then you go to the welfare people. And you say, look, we're not going to pay you for sitting on your duff. You got to go to work if you want to eat. Oh, what kind of a cruel person are you? Think that somebody ought to have to work just so they can eat. In other words, if there's no more free lunch, we could stop this. But you know, people are funny. My father's not here tonight, so I'm going to tell a story about him. My father's the most conservative guy you ever met. I mean, he doesn't like all these people at the public trough. However, he owns some land up in Palmdale adjacent to where they're supposed to build an airport. He thinks the one legitimate function of government is to build airports. He doesn't like anybody else's slot at the trough, but by gosh, if you don't build those airports, well, what are people going to do? Can't expect the airlines to build them just because they use them. And you go to a farmer, and you talk to him about all those city people on welfare, and he is incensed. You talk to him about eliminating the parity program. You just stuck a dagger in his heart. See, everybody's got their own slot at the trough. These socialists aren't stupid. They haven't come to you with vinegar. They've come with sugar. They go to the doctor. Now, doctors used to be very opposed to socialized medicine. So these guys are smart. Did they go to the doctor and say, look, doc, tough rocks, but you're going to become a government bureaucrat whether you like it or not? They didn't go to the doctor like that. They said, doc, you're doing a lot of charity work. We think you ought to get paid for that. Not only that, we'll do your billing for you and your collecting. And you don't have to give away your services anymore. Isn't that a good deal, doc? And those docs said, yeah, give it to me. That's how we got socialized medicine. Once they get the foot in the door, they just keep turning on more and more and more. They go to everybody and they first offer you taxes? No, they offer you a subsidy. Whatever business you're in, they got a subsidy for you. What we have today is the pickpocket society. It's just like you've got your hand in your neighbor's pocket, And you're running your hands through his wallet trying to pull out the big green ones. And the guy on the other side's got his hand in yours. And it's a big daisy chain. We're all trying to pick each other's pocket. And we're all hoping, boy, I hope I can steal more than they're stealing from me. Now, I submit to you, ladies and gentlemen, any society where people live based upon their ability to steal from their neighbors is doomed. Because your neighbor's going to retaliate. You know, it's funny. Most people would not sneak into their neighbor's home in the middle of the night. You know, you cut the screen and you come in and you go in and you take his wallet out, you filch his money, put it in, sneak out. Most people aren't going to do that. Why, that's dishonest. But they'll get a politician to do it for them. Why, that's democracy. Now, I submit to you, if you think about it, first place, you got to hire more and more bureaucrats to supervise the stealing, don't you? And those bureaucrats don't produce anything. They're just kind of trying to organize the stealing to keep it on some kind of a organized basis so it doesn't get too chaotic. Pretty soon, more and more people are supervising and fewer people are out there producing anything. There's going to be less and less to divide. So any society based on stealing is going to fall. But to go to people and say, all right, we're going to stop stealing, that's pretty tough. All right, so inflation is an increase in the money supply. That is the cause. The effect is that when all that money starts circulating through the economy, it bids up prices. It's the increase in the cost of living that people get upset about, what is fallaciously called inflation. Pretty soon, the politicians who are at fault for all of this start saying, we've got to control inflation. Now, when all those politicians back in Washington start talking about controlling inflation, do they mean that the government better quit spending more than it takes in? No. They mean we got to have wage and price controls. In other words, the politicians are blaming the people that didn't cause the problem in the first place. Some of the most poignant statements I have ever seen in my life about why wage and price controls are bad were made by Richard Nixon. He said, I will not take this country down the road to wage and price controls. They're bad for business, they're bad for labor, and they're bad for consumers. And he said they will lead to shortages and black markets. So that's why I will never take this country down the road to wage and price controls. What did he do? Had a change of heart and a lapse of memory. In fact, he used to say, it is a great analogy, he said, putting wage and price controls on an economy at the same time you're inflating the money is like clamping a lid on a boiling cauldron and turning up the heat. Eventually, what has to happen? You either take the thing off and it all pours over, or if you let it go, it explodes. Right on, Dickie. And then he turned around and did just exactly what he said he wouldn't do. That's why you can't say this guy is dumb. He's not dumb. He knows exactly what he's doing, because you can go back to things he said in the past that absolutely lead you to know that he knows the consequences of what he's doing. Have wage and price controls stopped inflation? You got to be kidding. Inflation has doubled, hasn't it? I hate to use that word wrongly, the cost of living, the increasing cost of living has doubled since they put on the wage and price controls. What has happened? Oh, we got shortages. Shortages. Because pretty soon, you know, people stop selling things and things become scarce and on allocation. Instead of having salesmen around, now you got a bunch of allocators. And it only takes a shortage of one little part in something like an automobile, let's say, and the automobile doesn't come off of the line. Now I'll go to part two of my goodies here. Part of what we've had is the energy shortage. Now what they've done in the energy shortage, particularly oil, which I think probably concerns most of you, is that they have greatly increased demand at the same time they have restricted the supply. Now again, you don't have to be any whiz-bang to figure out that if you increase demand for something and restrict the supply, you're headed for shortages. We have been told that our problem with oil is that we're just running out. Well, that's not true. According to Copley News Service's Don Oakley, for every one of the billions upon billions of barrels of petroleum the United States has consumed since Colonel Drake drilled the first well in 1859, at least another barrel remains in the ground. And according to the U.S. Geological Service, a figure of 100 billion barrels of oil, at least at the minimum, remain in the ground, and the figure may exceed several hundred billion barrels of oil that we still have as reserves in this country. There is oil all over the world. This is from the Los Angeles Herald Examiner, July 20th, 1970. Headline, Oil Riches Lie Offshore Los Angeles. The untouched Los Angeles Basin, just offshore Malibu, Santa Monica, and the beaches southward to Palos Verdes, probably holds an oil and gas potential in excess of 75 billion barrels. That is an educated guess of petroleum geologists today. This prediction was made by the National Petroleum Council in a report on a study of petroleum potential of the U.S. begun in 1968. In pointing out the vast potential of offshore areas, the report takes no note of the move to halt drilling in the Santa Barbara Channel, which may hide some 10 billion barrels. The Los Angeles Basin is the richest of the U.S. basins. Offshore of the San Joaquin Valley reserves are estimated at 12.6 billion barrels, and off Ventura, 5 billion barrels. Then in 1972, there was an oil field as big as Alaskan oil reserves found on the Atlantic Shelf. This headline says, Giant Oil Field Along Atlantic Shelf. Here's another one. Oil deposits found in sea off New York. From the Los Angeles Times, tremendous U.S. shale oil reserves find an asset at increased prices. Rich oil fields found off southern Mexico. In other words, there's oil everywhere. And as the price has gone up, it becomes more feasible to get out a lot of these marginal oil reserves that they have. All right, there's all this oil around. Why we have this doggone gas shortage? This is from the Los Angeles Times. It's entitled, Now Wait a Minute About That Santa Barbara Oil Spill. And this is a story about a marine biologist named Dale Strawn from USC who led a team of scientists in finding out actually how bad that oil spill at Santa Barbara was. Now you remember all that because Remember, you turn on your television set and you'd see somebody there with an oily seagull, and they would say, "This, ladies and gentlemen, is an oily seagull." And we were led to believe that the Union Oil Company didn't want to take that oil out of the ground and put it in barrels and sell it to you. They just wanted to dump it in the ocean because they got great glee from dirtying up the ocean. And we were told that the ecology had been destroyed. Well, when this team of scientists went out and actually did a study to see how bad that oil was, they came up with some quite different conclusions. This is from the LA Times. "One by one, the foundations of the Dead Sea Forever theory were refuted by the USC findings. No ill effects on animals and vegetable plankton could be discerned." Skipping here. "No damage from oily pollutions could be found on sandy beaches. A decrease in marine life was observed in oil tide zones, but a decrease in internal tidal life was also measured on shore far from the spill. The channel fish catch was actually found to have been greater in a 6 month period following the oil spill than in any comparable period the year before." In other words, the oil spill, which was certainly nothing to be very happy about, was blown up all out of proportion. And this was used as an excuse to stop offshore oil drilling all over the United States. Now, there have been 14,000 offshore oil wells drilled. There were three major spills, of which the one here in Santa Barbara was one. Three out of 14,000. Now, if that's not a pretty good batting average, I don't know what is. But on the basis of that, they stopped offshore oil drilling. And then the ecology nuts got in and stopped the Alaskan oil field pipeline. They said, if you put a pipeline from where the oil fields are down to the harbor, it will destroy the ecology of the caribou. Oh, isn't that awful? People down here are supposed to stand in gas lines 3 or 4 hours a week so that the caribou won't have to jump over a pipe. People who believe that are known as humanitarians. And they said, this pipeline will hurt the tundra. What is tundra? Well, tundra is a gooey, mucky mud over a frozen subsoil. We sure wouldn't want to hurt that, would we? I mean, where are you going to go on your vacation next summer if you can't go up and see the tundra? So for 5 years, they delayed the Alaskan pipeline. If they had built that back when they expected to, there would be no gas shortage today. There's about a 2 million barrel a day shortfall, and that's what we'd be getting out of Alaska. Then the ecology people stopped them from building refineries anywhere. You know, who wants a refinery in their backyard? So nobody builds any refineries, but everybody'd like gas. So then, I saw the greatest bumper sticker the other day. It said, I hope these ecology freaks freeze to death in the dark. Now, at the same time that this is going on, the government has decided that you can solve the smog problem by putting anti-smog devices on automobiles. Now, today's automobile, it's no secret why they canceled the mobile economy run, is it? You know, cars that used to get 15 miles to the gallon are now getting 8. What does that mean? It means they use a lot more gas than they used to. This year, they're producing 85% as much gasoline as they did a year ago. But there are 11 million more cars on the road than there were a year ago. And those cars are all gas eaters. Now, I'm not an expert. I do a lot of clipping. And I've seen, for instance, an article in the Wall Street Journal that talked about the New Jersey State Police ran a bunch of tests on their police cars as to whether or not all this smog device equipment did any good. And they found out, according to them, it made it worse, not better. In other words, instead of getting 15 miles a gallon, you get 8 and you produce more smog. So the demand for gasoline is up 20 or 30% over what it was 4 or 5 years ago. It's going, well, more than that, it's going up about 10 or 12% a year. And when you increase demand and decrease supply, you have shortages. Government caused the shortages. You know, there's a lot of people that think that this thing is phony. Well, it is and it isn't. There's no excuse for it. It's a phony deal, but it is real. You find in almost every problem we have in this country that the government either creates the problem or takes a problem and makes it worse, and then they come in with a solution, which is always more government. That way you get a bigger and bigger and bigger government, more and more power for the politicians, more and more power for the bureaucrats, higher and higher taxes for the people, and less control you have over your own lives. So now it's to the point, I have not been able to train my car to run low on gas only on odd number days. My car is not that Pavlovian. But at the same time that we can't get gasoline in this country, we read in the Los Angeles Times that the Export-Import Bank is going to finance oil pipeline for the Arabs. Terrific. You can't get pipe in this country. Why? Because wage and price controls, or price controls, have frozen the price of pipe at below the level that the pipe makers can sell it at a profit. So what do? They're selling the pipe overseas. They're selling pipe to the Arabs. Tremendous demand for pipe in this country. In fact, in my own situation, we're going to be drilling oil wells in July. But our biggest problem is we can't get enough pipe. If we could get more pipe, we'd drill 4 or 5 times as many wells as we're going to drill. But you can't get pipe. There, and back in the East, where they've got a lot of these old oil fields that have been around for many, many years, they now have crews out scouring these old oil wells, digging up this old cruddy pipe to use again in new wells. It's that short. Why is it short? Well, because they get their the pipe makers are selling it to the Arabs because they can't sell it to Americans at a profit. Who's causing that problem? The government. Then we're doing lots of other little goodies to solve our problem. This is from the LA Times from April 23rd of last year, U.S. to be main market for Algerian oil and gas. In other words, we are building gigantic complexes in communist Algeria and buying their gas at a greatly inflated price. We're paying for building it, and yet we have our own natural gas people under price controls. Then if you want to start smelling rats, here's one from July 4th of last year. South Vietnam takes a big step to develop oil. Seems that they've discovered a big oil field off South Vietnam. And right next to it, there's another oil field. U.S. firms and Peking discuss exploration for oil in China. You know, for years and years, Richard Nixon said we should never recognize the Red Chinese. And then they discovered oil in China, and David Rockefeller went over there, set up the Chase Manhattan Bank as Red China's correspondent bank for the United States, and then Richard Nixon went over there and said, we're going to change all this. Why? Because we're going to get a lot of oil out of Red China. Here's from the Times, U.S. seen as a buyer of Russian oil. Here's from the South China Morning Post, September 22, 1972. Oil bonanza could spark China's new five-year plan. Here's from the Wall Street Journal, August 22, 1973. Russians seek to sell oil and gas to U.S. in return for help in developing resources. In other words, we can't develop Alaska. We can't develop all this oil. It's right off your coast, right off here. But there's nothing wrong with going over and developing the Russians' oil, becoming dependent upon them. Government caused the problem. Yes, there is a shortage of gas. Yes, there is a shortage of oil. You know, the government is so, I hesitate to say stupid because some of them got to know what they're doing, but there are about 10% fewer gas stations today than there was a year ago. When the government put them on allotment, it put the remaining stations on an allotment of 85%, and the gas companies are holding fuel because the ones that went out of business obviously can't get their allotment. So the gas is in storage plants, but the government won't let them give it to your local dealer that's still open because he can't get any more than 85% of what he had last year. So what is the answer? Well, we've got all the liberals saying, what are we wasting time for? Let's establish rationing right now. Now, does rationing produce more gasoline? Is suddenly going to be more gas at the pump if it's rationed? No. What do we have if there's rationing? Well, they've already spent several million dollars printing the coupons. They figure with the bureaucrats they have to hire that the rationing program will cost over $1 billion. And it will certainly lead to black markets. You know, during World War II, because most people in this country were behind that war, people were fairly good about gas rationing. They accepted it as a necessity. They felt it was a necessity. Now, how many people do you know that wouldn't cheat on gas rationing if we had it today? Practically nobody wants it. I may go in the business of counterfeiting government ration cards if they go in the gas business. I don't even think that's dishonorable, to tell you the truth. Something like a little free enterprise to get things moving.
What will you sell them for?
For you, a special price. All right, now there's a food problem, too. As a matter of fact, I think that food is going to be the next big shortage. You've all read in the paper about people getting in fist fights at gas stations. Now, if people are going to get a little mean and nasty because they can't get gas, what do you think it'd be like if they couldn't get food? Oh, people are going to get real unhappy. Here's from the Santa Ana Register, February 16th last year. We take land from production while food shortage worsens. We're still paying some farmers not to produce. Meanwhile, food is going up. Feed costs force chickens to be killed. Remember last year when they were killing all those chickens? Because of why? Wage and price controls? Again, the price of feed went up so much that they couldn't afford to feed the chickens and then sell them at a profit. Why did the price of feed go up? Well, you remember last year, the great grain steal? When those great Republican businessmen sold half of our wheat crop or our grain crop to Russia at about 40% below market? Now, all that grain that went to Russia was grain that couldn't be fed to cattle and poultry in this country. So what happened? Well, the price of meat went way up. The number one cost in your state is feed. And feed tripled and quadrupled. What we are headed for now, we've had this tremendous rise in the price of meat, and now it's going down a little bit because those cattle are all being slaughtered. And then in the long run, we are headed for a tremendous cattle shortage. If you want a piece of practical advice, go out and buy a freezer today and stuff it with frozen meat. Meat will never again be as low in price as it's going to be in the next month or so. Then it's going to the moon. Another problem with our food. LA Times, fertilizer shortage brings threat of higher food prices, rationing. Much of the fertilizer is a product, a byproduct of petroleum. Petroleum shortage, fertilizer shortage. Here's out of Long Beach Independent. China purchases soybeans. Last year we gave the crop away to the Russians. A big percentage of this year's crop was going to the Russians, and now we've added the Red Chinese on there. Of course, they're doing it all on borrowed money. Terrific deal. Here's from this week's Los Angeles Times, March 14th, 1974. Dollar a loaf cry is exaggerated, but not by much, says top baker. We're running out of wheat because we gave it away to the Russians. Now you're starting to see rationing of food foreseen by expert. LA Times, brace yourself. Here comes the food crisis. Here's from Sylvia Porter, economic writer for the syndicated columnist. Food rationing, hard to believe, but outlook grim. Wall Street Journal, the growing threat of world famine. They expect the cost of food to go up 30% this year. Imagine, it went up 18% last year. They expect it to go up another 30% this year. All right, what can you do to protect yourself? You know, I've always, in the past, kind of laughed at these people that talk about storing a little food. I'm not laughing anymore. And I don't think you ought to laugh either. There are so many things that could interrupt the flow of food to your supermarket. And you know, every time there's any kind of a crisis, Mrs. Smith says to Mrs. Jones, let's get down to that supermarket and get some food before the hoarders get there. I think the prudent thing is for each one of you to protect yourself first. You protect yourself monetarily by getting your money away from anything that's expressed in dollar terms, because we don't know what a dollar is worth. They keep printing so many of them. You know, it used to be that life insurance was the cornerstone of everybody's investment program, and it was really a good idea back when the dollar was backed by gold and they couldn't print all the dollars they wanted. But now the dollar is no longer backed by gold, and the government can and is printing all the dollars it wanted. And so that you have a contract that says 30 years from now, we're going to pay you $494 a month, how do you know what that's worth? It's funny, you go back and read the old magazine ads about how I retired in Florida on $200 a month. Well, that's back when guys were making 90 cents an hour wages. But guys today are making $5 an hour wages. But that money doesn't buy much. And we're on this treadmill, and they're not going to stop it. They are going to continue to print that money. You have to hedge your position by getting your money into real, tangible things that may protect you. And I want to tell you something. You know, a lot of people come along with a panacea. If you'll just go along with my investment, if you'll put your money in this kind of silver or that kind of gold, or if you'll put it in this kind of land or something, we'll protect you. This thing can be so bad, there is nothing that is guaranteed protection. Some things are better than others. You know, it's like, I would rather live in Thousand Oaks than in Watts. But that doesn't mean that you're necessarily going to be safe out here. But first, you have to protect yourselves. That's just good sense. Secondly, what we are going to have in this country is somewhat the akin of a bunch of sheep stampeding. Because things are going to get rough. I wish I could come up here and say things are going to get better before they're going to get worse, but I'd be lying to you. They're going to get worse before they get better. And the public at some point is going to panic. And they will either panic right off the cliff into total destruction and maybe taking you with it, or they will panic back from the cliff and undo the something for nothing, rob Peter to pay Paul, welfare state, and we'll go back to everybody earning his own bread. Now, which way these people panic at the critical time is going to depend upon who can exert the most pressure. That's why the more people there are who are actively out in this battle of education depends upon your survival. That doesn't mean just educate yourself. That's where you begin. Then you start educating your neighbors, and it's a race. And I can't tell you when the critical time is going to come. I can't tell you whether it's a year from now or 5 years from now or 10 years from now. I hope it's 10 years from now. But I don't have a crystal ball. I can't tell. I just know that the more people that know who really caused all these problems, the better our chances are in the long run of solving them. And what's more, that may sound kind of nebulous to you, but it is our only chance. This country is dying because people are ignorant of some very basic elemental facts. And what we have to be is an army of educators armed with pamphlets going out fighting ignorance. And if you're not willing to do that, then you are guaranteeing that when the crunch comes, that you and your family are going to get wiped out in the tide of the stampede. So I've wandered on long, long past when I should. I certainly appreciate your kind attention. I will be here afterwards for people that want to come ask me specific questions. I certainly appreciate you coming out on a Friday night. And now you can stop listening to me and go next door and hear all that good music. Thank you.